From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last Friday, a federal appeals court ordered the government to give courts and defense attorneys much greater access to information on Guantanamo detainees challenging their imprisonment. Also recently, the Supreme Court reversed itself and agreed to consider the legality of the military tribunals that try them. Journalist Sami Al-Haj is one of those detainees, arrested at the Pakistan-Afghanistan border in December 2001. He intended to cross into Afghanistan to cover the U.S. military operation there. Instead, he spent 6 months in detention and then was packed off to Guantanamo, where he is today. Al-Haj is the only journalist imprisoned at Guantanamo. He was crossing into Afghanistan to cover U.S. military operations there for Al Jazeera. In fact, his lawyer claims that's the main reason he's still in Gitmo, a U.S. government grudge against the Middle East's leading news channel. Rachel Morris is an editor at The Washington Monthly. She spent the past 7 months covering Al-Haj's case for the Columbia Journalism Review. She said that since he was detained, he has been charged with an ever-changing series of misdeeds.
When he initially got there, there was some allegations about attempting to purchase Stinger missiles in Chechnya. More recently, there have been things about him carrying money, which made its way to charities that supported terrorists in some way. There's also things about him having once met an Al-Qaeda lieutenant, but with no explanation of what the meeting involved. Those are the sort of more serious ones in the summary of evidence against him. And there's also a long list of vaguely suspicious sounding things that he said to have done without a lot of context about what they might mean.
Al-Haj's lawyer told you that 120 of his 130 interrogations at Guantanamo have been about Al Jazeera, its internal workings, its principal funders, the backgrounds of individual presenters, not about any charges against Al-Haj.
His lawyer has also said, by the way, that at one point in an interrogation that Al-Haj was offered the possibility of release if he would go back to Al Jazeera and provide information about Al Jazeera.
Spy, in other words.
Well, I think there's a clique inside the government that sees Al Jazeera as, at best, a mouthpiece for terrorists. It's been very well documented that Donald Rumsfeld, people in the office of the vice president, have a very, very low opinion of Al Jazeera and do almost essentially see it as the enemy.
You asked the Defense Department how significant a factor in Al-Haj's continued detention is his background as a former Al Jazeera employee, a journalist. And how do they respond?
Well, they didn't give me a very direct response to that question. What they basically said was that all the people in Guantanamo are unlawful enemy combatants. And there's no special category of, you know, the law or the military regulations governing detainees that would provide an exception or some sort of special treatment to a reporter or a member of a media organization. But it's certainly quite telling that when they summarize all these things that he said to have done, that interviewing the Taliban seems to carry the same weight as carrying money that makes its way to a terrorist organization.
Seems, suggests. The fact is, you don't really know what the charges are. You don't know what the evidence is. The Defense Department won't talk to you. At best, you can get some time with the lawyer of the detainee if he has one. So how do you deal with the fact that your story is going to be, of necessity, one-sided?
It's a really uneasy experience for any reporter, I think. Obviously, you can do a little more than talk to the lawyer. I did manage to speak to someone who had lived in the cell next to Sami Al-Haj to corroborate some of the things that his lawyer had told me about how he'd been treated. But still, your opportunity to do that, I think, are quite limited. I think all you can do is basically say that the issue of Guantanamo for journalists is sort of a special case. Because your opportunities for getting an official side of the story are limited, and because the legal processes for the detainees down there are so flawed, in that circumstance, it's a necessary and legitimate thing for journalists to present the best collection of information that they can find about a person and say, to the best of our knowledge, this is what we could learn about this person who's down there. we asked the Defense Department to elaborate on it and weren't successful. You can't really write it like a normal story either. I think if you're at least honest about where your information came from and what you could and couldn't do, then I think that that helps to an extent. It's certainly not ideal, but it's better than saying, I can't do a balanced story, so I'd better not do one at all.
Rachel, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Rachel Morris is an editor at the Washington Monthly. Her story, Prisoner 345, is in the current issue of the Columbia Journalism Review. So what is Al Jazeera's response to Sami Al-Hajj's 5.5-year detention? For more than a year after his arrest, there was virtually no response from Al Jazeera. Now the channel broadcasts weekly updates on developments in his case. Ahmad Ibrahim is a producer at Al Jazeera's headquarters in Doha, Qatar. He made a documentary about Sami Al-Hajj called Prisoner 345, and he's become the spokesman for Al-Hajj's case at Al Jazeera, even though he's never actually met him. Ahmad, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much for having me.
I know you weren't there at the time, but what have you heard of the reaction in the newsroom at Al Jazeera's headquarters when they first got word of Sami Al-Hajj's detention?
There was a lot of confusion because of the lack of information. We were not told that he was arrested by any particular authority. We had to look for Sami and where Sami was held. Initially, the Pakistani authorities told us that they were holding him on suspicions of links to Al-Qaeda, that the thing was not very serious. After that, in January, he was moved to American custody, to Bagram. And again, we didn't hear anything. Around the summer of 2002, his wife receives a letter from him, from Washington. And it said, I hope you're well. I'm in the place that God chose for me to be in, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. She was stunned. All of us were stunned. All of the journalists who were there were stunned. But there was a lot of obstacles prohibiting Al Jazeera from, you know, taking his cause.
I'm interested in those obstacles. It took until early 2003 for Al Jazeera to really begin covering his case. You have this powerful ability to disseminate information throughout the region. Why did Al Jazeera wait?
Because there's a lot of political difficulties because of the lack of information. I think his family even felt that there was something that they didn't know about their own son. You know, to think that America would hold people, would hold innocent people, was incomprehensible at those in that time. You know, people will experience torture and imprisonment and arbitrary arrest in our part of the world. They have never conceived of the United States doing that.
Let's set some of the context here. This was around the same time as Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld essentially labeling Al Jazeera the enemy or even a terrorist organization. It was also within the context of Al Jazeera's Kabul office being bombed in 2001 and another missile hitting its office in Baghdad during the invasion of Iraq, killing another correspondent in April of 2003. It may have seemed as if the news organization itself was under attack.
He was held in 2002. The office was bombed in 2001. The journalist was killed in 2003. They were all working more or less in the same regions of where America had gone, namely Iraq and Afghanistan. So the arrest might have been linked to those things. But 5.5 years later, after the initial arrest of Sami Al-Hajj, it's very strange that he's still in prison.
Ahmed, you have a website devoted to Al-Hajj's cause, prisoner345.net, and it features a rolling count of days, hours, minutes, seconds that he's been in Guantanamo. The site calls for his release. Are you sure that he's innocent?
It is up to the authorities that imprisoned him for 5 years to try him openly or to release him. It is not for me, because I didn't look at the evidence that they have against him to determine his innocence or his guilt. We think that he should be tried.
How is Al Jazeera covering Al-Hajj's case now?
What we're doing at the moment is for Sami's name and his plight never to be far away from the viewers of Al Jazeera. So on the scroll that we have his name and where people can go to support his case. We have a website that is focused on him, which is prisoner345.net. Some journalists around the world organize events of solidarity with Sami Al-Hajj. Some go on voluntary hunger strikes for a day or two. Some organize marches and events, especially in his home country of Sudan. So we cover all these things, and we invite his lawyers every time they come back from Guantanamo to tell us the latest on his situation.
It sounds a little bit like the way the BBC was handling the kidnapping in Gaza of their correspondent, Alan Johnston.
Correct. And there were some parallels with the issue of the British journalist Alan Johnston. The family of Alan Johnston did not know why their loved one was held in Gaza. The whole world didn't know why Alan Johnston was held in Gaza, and the whole world doesn't know why Samuel Hajj is held in Guantanamo. It's amazing when you can draw parallels between Gaza and the U.S., huh?
Can you describe the way this story and other stories out of Guantanamo have affected public opinion about the U.S. in the Arab world?
I can refer you to what Sami himself thought about the States in the extract that one of his interpreters had recalled. He says that I used to have a good opinion of the United States. I used to love this country, like many of the people around the Arab world. But this particular case, it's a prison that is there, that is continuing to hold people, 90% of whom were from this part of the world. And it's very difficult. When I meet some of the American officials, I say to them, it is in the interest of his family for Sami to be released. But it's in your interest that that prison is closed down.
Ahmad, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ahmad Ibrahim is a producer at Al Jazeera's headquarters in Doha. His documentary about Sami Al-Hajj, called Prisoner 345, was released last year. Coming up, the Army readies a new, improved field manual for fighting wars, and Iraq's Sunni insurgency reaches out to the Western press. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Will media mogul Rupert Murdoch swallow up the Wall Street Journal? Dow Jones's board of directors signed off on the deal last week, but the Bancroft family is serving as the obstacle the paper's founders hoped it would be. For now. Over the 100 years the Bancrofts have held the majority of Dow Jones stock, the family tree has grown a little unwieldy. Truth is, this family has issues. Conflicts among parents and children and all of their lawyers, and it seems the fate of one of the nation's few remaining influential family-owned newspapers hangs on some sort of conflict resolution, perhaps as early as next week. It turns out that the news organization that's reported best on the Bancrofts is The Wall Street Journal. Sarah Ellison has been following that story. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, the reason why the Bancroft family was given a controlling share of Dow Jones to begin with was so they could act as guardians for the paper and balance journalistic integrity with business interests?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, this is what happened when the company went public. The Bancrofts got super voting shares, so they control 10 votes for every one share. And it's exactly for that purpose. And what we've been looking at is how this mission has been passed down. One of the younger members of the generation didn't even realize that his family owned the Wall Street Journal or that they had any money until he saw his mother's tax return sitting out on a table at one point. So it's not something that has been instilled through every single member of the Bancroft family over the generations. Unlike a place like the New York Times, they don't have an Arthur Sulzberger who's the publisher of the paper. There's no Bancroft that is running things day to day at the Wall Street Journal. And so I think that some people saw over many years that that was a strength because they were just letting the paper be completely independent and they were just supporting it through their ownership. But now it adds a whole different dynamic to this situation because some of them don't feel the same kind of connection.
We hear that the Bancrofts are looking for potential buyers to counter Murdoch's offer. Is this a new effort?
It's relatively new. It's certainly come out since the Murdoch offer. I think this is relatively new to them to try to really learn about what's going on inside the company and how to fix it, particularly with what's going on in the rest of the newspaper industry right now. Some of the family members, particularly Leslie Hill, has been very active at looking at alternatives for the company. Christopher Bancroft is trying to raise money to buy out the rest of the family members who want to sell.
You mentioned Christopher Bancroft. You mentioned Leslie Hill. Who are they and who do they represent?
Well, there are sort of broadly three branches of the Bancrofts. Lisa Steele is another Bancroft family member that's on the board of directors. So the three of them represent the three different branches of the family. Leslie Hill is within the family known as very determined and sometimes contrarian. We know that Christopher Bancroft has expressed to people that he likes Murdoch's news properties as a consumer. So he doesn't have a sort of political difference with Murdoch, but is still seen as someone who's been working to block the deal because he believes in the independence of Dow Jones.
So when the Dow Jones board endorsed this sale, it also said that it would create a special committee to oversee the editorial direction of the paper, at least make sure it doesn't get mucked with. And that includes both the news side and the editorial board, which are enormously different. I don't think there is a thicker wall between editorial and news than there is at the Wall Street Journal. A list of the proposed candidates for this committee was leaked. Very little journalistic experience in that panel, but a lot of real strong politics, including Ted Olson, the lawyer who defended Bush in Bush v. Gore. Can a board like this actually protect editorial integrity at the Wall Street Journal? Can a board like this with any membership work?
Well, the last question is I think the one that most people have been asking, which is how much can you really put your own owner in a cage? And I think people are skeptical about if you can do that and if you should try to do that. In terms of the makeup of the board, there was an effort to find people who would at least understand the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. The question is, do you need to be a journalist to be able to make smart decisions about journalism? And I think some people don't think that that's the case. And it's better to not have someone who's mucking around with small decisions about what the paper does and that acts more as sort of an appeals board for the paper. It's really untested, though, and I don't know how it'll work out.
Here you are. You're part of a team that's been covering this story really well. And you know that there have been petitions circulated and an enormous amount of concern over what happens to some of the signature features of the paper, like the wonderful middle of the front page long feature that's so fun to read, which Murdoch apparently hates. So do people come up and say, you got to write this, you've got to write that?
Yeah, it makes covering a story like this all the more emotional, and there's just no way around that. I mean, we are covering ourselves, and this is going to have an impact on all of us. The textbook answer is that you try to cover this like you would any other story, and that you do have certain journalistic reflexes and muscles that kick in as you're doing it that actually help you more than you would think. You have a deadline, you have this information, you're making calls, and you put it in the paper like you would with anything else. But there are moments where you realize, of course, you're writing about your own future.
Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sarah Ellison is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. According to the General Accountability Office, there are more than 5,000 insurgent attacks each month against coalition troops, Iraqi security forces, and civilians. The vast majority, by some estimates, 70%, are carried out by groups not affiliated with al-Qaeda in Iraq. They're mostly shadowy bands of nationalist or Islamic factions from whom we never hear, except in occasional internet posts or videos. But according to Guardian reporter Seamus Milne, that may soon change. Milne says that some Sunni insurgents want to open a line of communication with Western media, and he believes that Western journalists are obliged to listen. In fact, Milne arranged a meeting in Damascus, Syria, through a series of intermediaries, he says, with some of the most influential Sunni insurgent leaders in Iraq.
The people I met were leaders of three of the main resistance organizations in the predominantly Sunni areas of Iraq. They're part of a group of seven organizations that have decided to form an alliance or a front, as they would call it, with a common political program.
How did you verify the legitimacy of these people?
The evidence that they gave of their intimate knowledge of the internal politics of these organizations, the people who put me in touch with them, the trust that was invested in them, but also the provision of material, including videos and tapes and photos that are not available on the internet and other things like that. But I mean, you know, if we'd been wrong, they would have immediately cried foul once the articles were published.
How do you think reporting in Iraq would change if there were actually an official spokesperson of the Sunni insurgency?
Well, I think that's what they are trying to do. I mean, they're trying to find a way of having a public face, some sort of calling card and posting box where the global media and the Iraqi media and the Arabic media can come for comments and to engage in a political dialogue with them. I mean, as they themselves say, they're in a particularly difficult situation because they regard themselves as the first resistance movement in modern history which is not supported by any outside power. And the reason for that is because of the power they're fighting, namely the US, which has the power to force any other state that were to give them sanctuary not to do so or to pay a very high price for that. I mean, I think there are some signs that the American administration and the occupation forces themselves are beginning to, from time to time, either talk to sections of the resistance through back channels or even partly cooperate with them against al-Qaeda, as has been taking place, I think, sometimes in Anbar province. And maybe that will happen more in the future. But I think it's a sort of process of kind of feeling their way forward in a quite a fast evolving situation.
Seamus, I think you've really laid out their strategy very clearly, but I'm also interested in how it will influence you. I mean, these guys are saying, we're here, we can give you quotes, we deserve a lot more ink. What's your response as a journalist to that?
Covering the Iraq war has become incredibly difficult in the last couple of years because of the security situation in the country. Many, many stories are not seeing the light of day at all. But I think there's an incumbency on all of us, and especially media organizations from the countries that are occupying Iraq, to try and tell the real story of what's going on there and what the people who are significant there want to say. And I think partly because of this security situation, it's been possible to present the resistance to the occupation as, from the outside world's point of view, a bunch of bloodthirsty lunatics, rather than actually some profoundly rooted organizations and forces in the country that in the end you're going to have to deal with. So I think this is part of a process that from the media point of view, the Western media point of view, we have to respond to. You know, these people need to be interviewed and challenged, not just by Arabic satellite TV stations and newspapers, but also the main newspapers and TV stations, radio stations in the US and Britain and other Western countries.
As you wrote in your piece, these groups distinguish themselves from al-Qaeda in Iraq in that they say they never target civilians. They only target combatants, whether Iraqi or American or British. And I just wonder, did you have any qualms meeting with these people, or would you have had any misgivings if al-Qaeda had set up a similar meeting, or is it just, you know, it's not your role to pass judgment or have qualms?
No, I think it's the job of the media to report these things on the ground as they are, not as we'd wish them to be. I mean, the problem with talking to al-Qaeda is mainly a security one rather than a moral one.
But you don't feel as if you were being used?
Well, that's, I mean, for any media organization, when it's talking to any side in any conflict, there's always that danger, and you have to apply professional standards when you're dealing with them. And that applies to when you're talking to the British Army or the American occupation forces, as well as to people fighting on the other side. I mean, we have the problems of how you report on the British Army when you're embedded with them. That raises a whole lot of issues as well. I mean, it's our job as journalists to make sure that we're not allowing our agenda to be set by one side in the conflict.
Seamus, thank you very much.
Okay, very nice to talk to you then.
Seamus Milne is a reporter for The Guardian newspaper. The U.S. military is shaped by its soldiers, its officers, its missions, and its manuals. There are currently 542 Army field manuals. Chief among them is FM-30, called Operations, which lays out the fundamentals of warfighting for future and current generations of recruits. FM-30, due out in October, is getting its first update in 6 years, including some new priorities in the fight against insurgents. Near the top, influencing civilian populations so they'll help in the effort. The lead writer of the updated FM-30 is 25-year Army veteran, now civilian, Michael Burke, who told us what's new from his cubicle in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas.
Well, the key change we're making in this manual is emphasizing that the way we deal with the civilian population is equally important with the way we attack or defend against an enemy force. That's a key change in the way we've perceived our doctrine in the past. Unfortunately, in some cases, we've focused very strongly on the attack and defense against an enemy and perhaps not emphasized the civilian interaction as much as we are in this manual.
Do you think it's possible to get the message across to influence people, given the hits that the Army's image has taken with, you know, Abu Ghraib, with mounting civilian deaths, Guantanamo? Can this manual do anything to alleviate those public image disasters?
I don't know that the manual can directly alleviate what's already happened, but what the manual does do is urge, in some cases, returning back to basics, which is what the leadership has to understand is the role of things like the law of war, the Geneva Conventions, and Army regulations for the conduct of soldiers. But it also stresses the fact that you can't look at war, particularly land operations within war, you can't look at it as solely an exercise in military power directed against other military power. It's really about changing the environment in which you're ordered to operate. If we don't do that right, if we don't establish the initial conditions properly, then we're already behind the power curve. We've already created an atmosphere that it may be impossible for the other instruments of national power. Besides military, we have informational, diplomatic, and economic instruments for those to succeed.
Do you have any reason to believe that the leadership is even going to crack this manual?
Well, the Army leadership will, I have no doubt. The real impact of this type of manual is in the way it's absorbed within the education buildings of the Army. For example, right here at Fort Leavenworth, we have the brand new staff college building, and within it, you know, some 1,500 majors, really the heart of the Army's leadership, are going to be, you know, exposed to it in some depth, and they're going to weigh it against their own experiences and what they think is right. And whether they necessarily accept everything in it or not, it also provides a common language and basis from which all of our soldiers can make judgment calls as to whether they're going to do it the way the manual urges them to do it or to consciously do something different.
So what made the Army wait until October of this year to finally bring this out?
Well, I don't think that waiting is the right answer. The question is evolving from what was into what's going to come. A lot of these ideas were initially offered in the 2001 manual, which was quite a dramatic shift from where we'd been in terms of the Cold War and so forth. And what we had to do then was decide how those things that were in the 2001 manual, plus our operational experiences since 2001, how those added up to the way the Army should think about operations. If we're successful with this, this should inform the Army how to think, but it can't tell the soldier what to do. Hopefully, by shaping the way they think about operations, we've provided them the ability to respond flexibly and more often than not correctly to the situation.
Thanks very much.
Well, thank you for talking with me.
Michael Burke is the lead author of the new Army Field Manual 3.0. More often than not, he says, we can only hope. We only know what they tell us. The war at home, our war, is a war over the image of the war. For instance, in the New Republic, an anonymous soldier who this week identified himself as Private Scott Thomas Beauchamp has been blogging about casual cruelty in the field. A soldier who keeps a tally of the dogs he gleefully runs over with his Bradley fighting vehicle. A trooper who wore a cranium he found in a burial ground on his head. Some readers, among them Michael Goldfarb in the Weekly Standard and John Podhoretz in National Review Online, do not believe this blogger. And other soldiers claim that the Bradley can't do what Private Beauchamp says it can, and that ordnance he described doesn't exist. New Republic editor Franklin Foer couldn't talk to us by deadline. He was still investigating, and well, he should. His magazine has been burned by liars in the past. But he told the Washington Post that conservative bloggers make a living of denying any bad news that comes from Iraq. This week, another salvo in the image war was fired by the Liberal Nation magazine in the form of a special report based on interviews with 50 combat veterans on the record who witnessed or even participated in the killing of Iraqi civilians. Their stories are far, far worse than Private Beauchamp's. And finally this week, another image defeat for the military. We learn that several Army officers have been punished for lying about the death in 2004 of former NFL star Pat Tillman. The Pentagon claimed he died fighting the Taliban and gave him a posthumous Silver Star. In reality, he was killed by friendly fire. Up next, another war of images, this one on the silver screen. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a new expanded law on extremism, supposedly intended to stifle neo-Nazis and other hate groups. But it's written so broadly that it could be applied to any criticism of the Russian government. This is not an unusual move for Putin or for Russia. For most of the century, Russian media have been firmly under the thumb of the government. Of course, we Americans have no problem with criticizing Russia, especially in film. And Hollywood's portrayals usually track with our political relations. Now, with our geopolitical relationship in flux, so is our view of Russians on the big screen. Harlow Robinson is the author of the upcoming Russians in Hollywood, Hollywood's Russians, Biography of an Image. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
So you write that an obsession with the Russians happened early in Hollywood filmmaking. American audiences seem to find the Romanovs extremely sympathetic. How come?
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting historical fact that the Russian Revolution, 1917, coincided almost exactly with the creation of Hollywood. And on top of that, lots of Russians were flowing into Hollywood as refugees. And, you know, I think Americans have always been fascinated with monarchs. And politically, it was very urgent, the struggle between capitalism and communism after the Russian Revolution. I think all those factors contributed.
Well, let's focus on the political factor right now. One of the most successful early Russian characters was Greta Garbo's 1939 portrayal in Ernst Lubitsch's Ninotchka.
Right.
What about her resonated with American moviegoers?
Well, I think, for one thing, it's a very funny film. Ernst Lubitsch has that wonderful comic touch, and Billy Wilder was one of those who helped write the screenplay. But I think the story, you know, it was 1939 that that film came out, and following the Depression was when Americans were most interested in communism, actually. Ernst Lubitsch, interestingly, went to Russia in 1936, and he was extremely disillusioned with what he saw there and felt when he came back that he wanted to make this film. But being Ernst Lubitsch, of course, he made it a comedy and got the message across even better.
Now, I think this falls into the category of what you would call a conversion story.
Yes.
What's the quintessential moment there?
Well, she arrives in Paris, you know, as this extremely severe Soviet commissar. This is Greta Garbo. She sees this hat in a store window and she says, oh my goodness, if they're wearing such things here, it won't be long before capitalism collapses. But of course, the story is how she changes in the course of having met particularly this one playboy who at first she thinks is very silly and frivolous, but eventually he turns her head. And the moment when she actually goes and buys the hat and puts it on and admires herself in the mirror, the transformation has occurred.
Isn't that amazing? At home, there is still snow and ice in here. Look at the birds.
I always felt a little hurt when our swallows deserted us in the winter for capitalistic countries. Now I know why. We have the high ideal, but they have the climate.
Once we got into World War II, that must have put filmmakers in something of a bind. Our former foils were now our allies. How did some of the pro-Soviet films of the 1940s reconcile themselves with communism?
When the war began in 1941 and we became allies, actually the Roosevelt administration asked Hollywood producers to start producing films that would present the Soviet Union in a different light. And there were five or six very high-profile features that were made during that short period of time between 1941 and 1945. One of them is Days of Glory, starring Gregory Peck in his first big role.
And yet, it didn't take long for Cold War paranoia to reappear. Would you say that the films from the 50s sort of set the template for the Soviet villain slash zombie?
After the war and the Cold War, virtually all Russians who were seen in the movies became villains. One of my favorite films is called Red Danube from 1950, and it actually stars Janet Leigh, and she plays a fugitive ballerina who's in Vienna after the war when Soviets were being repatriated forcibly back to the Soviet Union. And she's trying to escape this fate. In the end, she ends up jumping out of a window and committing suicide because the idea of going back to the Soviet Union is so horrible to her.
Now, in the 60s and the 70s, amidst the evil communist portrayals, there came a kind of backlash in the form of satire.
By the early 60s, you know, you have films like Dr. Strangelove, and then the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming.
In Union of Soviet, many are saying Americans are bad people. All mistrust American. But I think that I do not mistrust American. I wish not to hate anybody.
And here there's a sort of different tone. It becomes the Soviet and Americans together against their leadership in a way.
Now, in the last decade of communist Russia, you wrote that Russian portrayals were just confused. You had Warren Beatty's Reds, who portrayed them as vaguely romantic. On the other hand, you had John Milius's Red Dawn, which was paranoia of the First Order. And then you had Paul Mazursky's Moscow on the Hudson with Robin Williams. I guess that's the quintessential conversion film.
Yes. And, you know, of course, remember that the late 70s, early 80s, defection was very much in the news. There were hundreds of thousands of Jews who were leaving the Soviet Union. And on top of that, all these artists who were defecting, you know, Baryshnikov, Nureyev, Godunov. So, you know, Moscow on the Hudson, it is a defection story. Robin Williams plays a Russian musician who's on tour with a circus in New York, and he defects at the fragrance counter in Bloomingdale's.
So what?
I defected.
You're not going to do that here. I told you where the men's room was.
I am Russian. I defect.
You're about ready to get maced.
Oh, my God, don't you get it? He's defecting.
So do you think filmmakers with all of these various portrayals were just trying to make sense of the end of the Cold War?
Oh, I think definitely. And, you know, these films of the 80s is an interesting kind of confusion in how to exactly take the USSR. Reagan's administration was very anti-Soviet. He called the Soviet Union the evil empire. And that was very much reflected in these films of the early 80s, like Red Dawn, where you have the Soviets invading Colorado.
It's World War III down there. People are being killed. Those could be Russians.
You've suggested that since the late 80s, there's been a kind of palpable feeling of loss in the portrayals of Russians. Regret, perhaps, that they don't fill the same role they used to?
Yes. I think there's a nostalgia for the certainties of the Cold War. You know, it's interesting in this most recent James Bond film, Casino Royale, Judi Dench, who plays, you know, the runner of the James Bond character, says, God, I miss the Cold War. Because it's hard to make sense of this new world. And I think you really see that in the films that have come out in the very recent years. The Russians still tend to be very negative. They're no longer communists, but now they're terrorists. They're mafioso.
Russia has loomed so large in the last century. Why do you think we're still so all over the place when it comes to depicting them?
Well, I think, especially since the collapse of communism, people are really unsure. Is this a friend? We were great buddies now. But it became clear that that was not really the case. Russia is still a great power with its own agenda. And so I think that also scares people.
Harlow, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Harlow Robinson is the author of Russians in Hollywood, Hollywood's Russians, Biography of an Image, due out this fall.
A hot dog, please.
Vladimir Ivanov?
Boris?
Don't worry, my friend. I am retired.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
What are you doing here?
Did you think I could go back to Moscow after what's happened? Have you been well?
Yeah. It's a strange country, huh?
Oh, yes. Strange and wonderful. Can I say thank you?
Sure.
Thank you.
Wait.
Oh, put your money away. Huh?
It's a good hot dog.
The best in New York.
See you.
Okay.
Russia's film industry has returned the favor of American depictions of Russians with its own portrayals of us. That sprightly vintage piano is from the VHS soundtrack of the Russian classic silent film The Extraordinary Adventures of Mr. West in the Land of the Bolsheviks. Directed in 1924 by Lev Kuleshov, it's an affectionate depiction of the trials and tribulations of a red-blooded Yankee in the socialist paradise.
So it's a kind of burlesque comedy Western style, presenting silly but sympathetic American who finally understands that life in Soviet Russia is not so horrible as he imagined it would be.
Kirill Razlogov is the director of the Russian Institute for Cultural Research and a scholar of Soviet and Russian cinema. He says that like Russian portrayals in American films, in Russian cinema, depictions of Americans underwent similar mutations. For instance, he says, in the early years of communism, Russia had no grudge against the States. After all, both countries had wide open spaces, and under Lenin, Russians even tested the water of free enterprise, briefly.
In fact, American cinema was very popular in Russia in the 20s. And there was this period of new economic policy where there was no specific reason to hate Americans, in a way because Russians felt near to Americans than to Europeans.
Russians felt a certain kinship. What was that based on, do you think?
I think it was based on an absence of this hierarchy.
You're talking about class differences.
Yes, class differences. And that all people are equal, all people want to live better, and the country is working to do it.
Was there also a sort of cultural character? I mean, a certain less polished, more pioneering quality or something like that? Or
less civilized quality.
I sort of meant that.
It's true.
And maybe that was partly a source of that kinship, do you think?
Yes, of course. The 20s and the 30s still went on the idea that there is this overall proletarian solidarity. For example, there have been adaptations of Jack London novels. And in these adaptations, of course, the idea of proletarian Americans, the good ones, and rich Americans, the bad ones, were very clearly drawn. And of course, there was a film like The Circus with this American lady played by Lyubov Orlova with his black child. It was kind of comedy melodrama. And the Soviet Russia receives this American lady with a black child just pushed from the United States. That's the typical film of the 30s, by the way.
Which shows tremendous racial prejudice.
Yes, tremendous racial prejudice in America and the absence of racial prejudice in Russia.
So then moving on to the 40s.
The 40s were the period when both countries fought the Germans. So there have been films which presented sympathetic Americans, people who fought the same war. The film that was the final blow to this image was a film called Encounter on the Elbe, which was the encounter between Russians and Americans at the end of the Second World War.
In this topsy-turvy account of history, an American conspires with Germans against the Russians.
Can I count on the German Social Democrats to create a special Eastern Bureau?
Absolutely.
I will prevent the labor parties from merging and will undermine the trust in communists.
I understand.
You say it was the final nail in the coffin of the good American?
Because it appeared almost at the same time that the speech by Churchill and the beginning of the Cold War.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is no time for generalities, and I will venture to be precise. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
And so that was the late 40s. When was the next milestone?
Oh, the next milestone for Russian film history was the mid-50s, where Khrushchev came to power. The period was fighting about the image of Stalin, and it gave more freedom to the intelligentsia, to people making films. There was still no permission to show personal relations between Russians and Americans except in being a spy or something like that. So the Hollywood dream story about a CIA agent loving a KGB agent was, for the moment, impossible.
And so we had the period of Gorbachev and Yeltsin. Was there a more realistic, less realistic notion of Americans during that period?
As far as the Yeltsin's period is concerned, the image of America moved from a political aspect to a criminal aspect. That means American mafia was the main character, and relations between American mafia and Russian mafia, American police force and Russian police force, which was the official policy supported by the state. That means that we have to get back to the idea of collaboration. And then the coming back to a nationalist point of view, the good Russians combating the bad Americans in the United States, like Brother 2. In Brother 1, the good guy kills every villain in St. Petersburg and goes to Moscow. In Brother 2, he goes to Moscow, then he moves to New York to kill the same villains.
Listen, what does it mean in English, how are you?
It means, how are you? How are you doing?
And they're interested in how I'm doing?
No, they're not interested.
So why do they ask?
For no reason. Everything here is for no reason, except for money.
Looking overall at the Soviet and Russian film history, it's far less stereotypical in its treatment of Americans than the American film industry has been in its treatment of Russians over the years. Is that your impression too?
There have been some stereotypical characters, but there was this undercurrent of sympathy to Americans which prevailed. There was never an image of, let's say, bad American because American. It was always an image of bad American because rich, or bad American because mafioso. Let's say senator was bad and government was bad. But there were always the good Americans, the repressed Americans, who were our counterpart of the Russian proletariat.
As my technical director ran through his head all the images of Russians he'd had, some of them were sympathetic. Some came from this cartoon show, Rocky and Bullwinkle, characters like Boris and Natasha. Then there was Ninochka. Mm-hmm. Then there was The Russians Are Coming with Alan Arkin. And I just wonder, when Russians encounter these different images, do they enjoy these films? Are you able to do that? Or are the reactions personal?
Oh, the official reactions are bad. It was almost impossible to make an image of Russians which was conformed to the official image of Russians during the Soviet period, of course. So no films with images of Russians were ever shown. And they were considered absolutely forbidden. It was worse than a porno movie.
I say thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kirill Razlogov is the director of the Russian Institute for Cultural Research and a scholar of Soviet and Russian cinema. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Wolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Andrea Ambro and Madeline Ellish. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. She just had a baby. And John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.